Come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If you work, be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Avast, me hearties. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network, WPRPN. With this year's Winter Olympics now in full swing, the tone of political reconciliation miraculously reverberates from across the Korean Peninsula. As we present to you this week's show, episode number 94 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Carmine Savastano is an author, researcher, and editor-in-chief of the Neopolis Media Group. His writings focus on intelligence, government, and international politics. He's studied legal documents for years, written over 60 research articles based on verifiable evidence, makes regular appearances in the media, and had several research findings accepted by the Mary Farrell Foundation and Assassination Archives and Research Center. Join us now as over the next 90 minutes or so, we traverse a whole host of pressing issues, including the latest on the JFK files, censorship in social media, and getting to the bottom of net neutrality. And we were just talking in the lead up to things here, Carmine and myself, how to maybe unpack or present things today. Welcome, everybody. Jaffe Ryder here, of course, episode 94, Pirate Radio Podcast. Thinking of maybe kicking things off with a little talk regarding social media, censorship and the like, followed up with net neutrality, and then get into the whole business of the JFK files, the Trump dump, as some have referred to it all, following that. So, Carmine, you were there in the wings, still standing by at the ready?
Yeah, good to be here,
Jeffy. That's great. Yeah, live from Dearborn, Michigan. Connecting here this week to the Korean Peninsula, we're a happening thing here. So thanks for joining us. Been looking forward to this for a while.
Yeah, no, it's good to be here. I was hoping to get in, and yeah, you guys have been, you know, really cool for giving me a chance to come on and discuss some of the issues with you.
One of the things that we like to say here right off the top, too, is that actually Carmine reached out to us, and we took a look at what it was that he was discuss this week and decided that, yeah, we would give it a go. Just to remind people that even though we are booked up all the way until around June of this year, if you can believe that, we're still open to guest suggestions and show ideas. So if anyone out there has any one or anything that they'd like to see showcased, by all means, you know, let us know. Pirate One Radio at Gmail or PirateOneRadio at ProtonMail.com. Both of those emails work just fine. So Dearborn, Michigan. Wasn't too sure about that, but yeah, it's kind of late out there, 11 p.m. at the moment. One of the first things that we started talking about, too, was the whole business of how there's a heavy Muslim demographic to the region. Is that not the case?
Yeah, I believe it's the second largest concentration of Muslim people in the world outside the Middle East.
How do people get along as far as different religions are concerned? Do people pretty much keep to themselves? Is there occasional outbursts of violence? Or what's the deal exactly? What do you figure?
I'd say most of the time everyone gets along fine. I think the culture clash is usually limited to a lot of the older members of the Muslim community or people who are recently immigrated to the United States who haven't really acclimated And, you know, they're still living as though they were back in the Middle East, but eventually, you know, there's so many changes. Usually most people acclimate and there's no problem. It's always struck me just for the amount of concentration how, and, you know, I hope it stays this way, but how safe it's been. With that many people, one would think that, you know, statistically, there might be a fringe person who would try to do something. But for the most part, you know, besides the occasional, you know, I've heard of high school fights and stuff like that, but nothing serious.
Knock wood.
Yep, hopefully it remains that way. Yeah. I really do think that also there's been such a large Muslim concentration here for so long, everyone's pretty much used to it. You know, kind of like the large concentration of Chinese people in San Francisco or in Los Angeles or parts of New York with large concentrations of Italians in the Bronx and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I totally get it. I think it'd be great if we could do a show regarding this whole business of Islam in the West and the so-called clash of civilizations, as some people frame it. Do you know who was it that wrote that book? Is not Samuel Taylor Huntington, or am I totally, is that the wrong name altogether? Brzezinski. Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Oh, was it? I don't know.
Yeah. Pretty sure. Yeah, we'd like to do a show on that, most definitely. I think that would be quite interesting and worth discussing. Maybe even a panel type format, in fact. So, and you might be somebody that we would welcome to that, given your vantage point. Probably a great deal of insight.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And, you know, if you wanted a panel atheist, more than happy to serve.
Sure. Pretty much anything goes here down in Skullport Harbor. That's where you currently happen to find yourself. Now, speaking of which, there was a little note that we sent you just an hour or two before the show regarding a potential pirate story. You wouldn't believe the number of times we've forgotten to do this, and it kind of gets under the captain's skin. According to our ship's articles, we are required and kind of expected to have our guest present a little something. As far as pirate stories, anecdotes, and the like are concerned, you could even do like a riddle or a sea shanty, perhaps, if you're...
I don't know how good my sea shanty skills are, but I thought of a little anecdote that it's not necessarily a story about pirates, but it would be a story about some people in the CIA who acted quite like pirates.
Let her rip. Let's hear it.
Well, there was a particular group in the Central Intelligence Agency called Staff D. They were in charge of cryptographic materials, or basically trying to decipher the code names and the intelligence foreign governments would use. For instance, there was a would-be assassin hired by the United States in the 1960s. His name was Rolando Cubella, and his cryptonym was AMLASH. And it usually the AM had to do with a locational prefix, and then the rest of it, LASH, would have been his part of the code name, but put together, that always represented him in the document so that they could hide his name so you wouldn't know who he was. So this group, Staff D, would, as pirates, their primary goal was to acquire cryptographic material from foreign governments. And usually how they would do that is basically acting as second story men and break into embassies or break into official installations and steal the information, bring it back and try to decode it back at headquarters.
And
so
the pirate angle, once again, I know you kind of... In the introduction to things, you kind of laid it out there, but just once again, refresh my middle-aged memory.
I believe that they acted as pirates because they would break into places, steal the treasures, the intelligence treasures of foreign governments, and then make off with them.
Sure, that makes sense.
Their actions, and of course, you know, it was a lot of pirates, the worst of the worst anyway, that we've heard of, would also try to conceal, and the CIA would do similarly. They would try to conceal their actions, blame it on other people. Use subversion to try to say that their people were in other places so they couldn't be linked to the robbery. And actually later on, Staff D, this cryptographic stealing was used as a cover for possible assassination missions that they were thinking about incorporating as well.
Pretty sneaky stuff. Standard operational procedures, I guess, is what a lot of it boils down to. But that, yeah, it's quite something. We'll have to make a note of that. And maybe follow things up here via the show notes, of course. So before we get into social media, censorship, and net neutrality and the like, cryptonyms. Oh, cryptonyms, yeah, okay.
Yeah, a cryptographic study would be a way. But basically it's cryptology.
And how did you first get into it? Tell us a little bit about, if you would, your background as far as your schooling is concerned, and what first caught your interest as far as cryptographics are concerned?
As you know, some people are good at puzzles. That's what I explained when I first broke a couple of cryptonyms, because people asked me, how did I do this? Because I'm largely, as far as cryptographic information goes, an amateur. But I've been able, with the help of others at the Mary Farrell Foundation and a number of them my own, to decipher these CIA cryptonyms. Now, the cryptonyms are, like I said, they're a combination of a locational prefix and then, you know, something to describe the subject. For instance, Operation Mongoose, they were used, as I said before, as code names. But what happened was, is as I was going through JFK documents, because I got into the case publicly, I was into it a few years before, but I publicly got into the case about 2013, where I started really trying to help people as best I could and make advancements and try to find new information and bring it to the public. And when I was going through the files, because a lot of people, unfortunately, rely just on books or on films, and they can be useful. They are, you know, good. Some of them are solid secondary sources. A lot of them are speculation, and a lot of them, you can't verify them legally. And that's one of the big things I think that people don't acknowledge in some of their research is, in my opinion, the ultimate goal of us researching these subjects, whether it's JFK or whether it's aliens or whether, no matter what subject you choose, if you're going to make progress and you're going to actually get perhaps legal changes or things to progress to where we can actually get some final answers for the public, it's going to need to be admissible in a courtroom. So I rely on official documents. A lot of people have told me, well, you know, there's been official documents that were proven changed and official documents that were false, and that's true. But the way that they were proven to be so is with other official documents, because they didn't match the pattern or the normal procedures that were followed. You could see they weren't real documents. So that to me doesn't apply. The majority, I'd say 99% of the official record is accurate and legal. And in my opinion, there's no better way to disprove official claims than with their own documents. And we can do that if we find people talk about the conspiracy. And I don't necessarily think, like right now, it's not a very popular outlook. Neither side has the definitive evidence. As far as the JFK case goes, we have those who believe in conspiracy who do have a substantial amount, and I'm one of them. And we do have a substantial amount of evidence to support a conspiracy. And we can prove that there were cover-ups, verifiable ones, where they lied repeatedly. We can see where they lied, where they even lied to each other internally. So that's not the problem. Conspiracy happened. Multiple conspiracies happened. It's the assassination conspiracy that we don't have definitive evidence for. And the other side, similarly, doesn't either. The Warren Commission, we know from, you know, looking at some of its files, Alan Dulles, who was on the Warren Commission, lied to the other members, didn't tell them that he approved the Castro plots in 1960 so that there were ongoing assassination plots before, during, and after JFK's murder. So every investigation has been compromised since. They've never been acting with the full knowledge of what was going on. So they're guessing, and that's fine. But people who support the official case need to realize they're just supporting a guess. The best guess of officials, not the truth.
Yeah, you're saying then these things cannot be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt without the official documentation there to substantiate the claims. What of, geez, you know, we're getting swept up in this.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go to jail, I know.
Right off the bat. But I'm just thinking, just generally speaking, I know that professional skeptics, some might even refer to people such as yourself as a debunker. Not a good thing, I wouldn't imagine, you know, to be painted with that brush. But well, personal anecdotes or testimony, I believe as they put it, eyewitness testimony, it's just you feel is, what are your thoughts on that? Just generally speaking, with outside, just, you know, JFK conspiracy, 9/11, you name it. Just generally speaking, what is the merit or value or the cons to be found in personal eyewitness testimony?
The big thing about eyewitness testimony, I try to balance it with, if it's eyewitness and they legally make a statement, then that does count as primary evidence. If they go and make a legal statement because they're taking the time to present what they're saying legally on the record and they're accepting the consequences, if any part of it is found to be fraudulent, they can be legally held to account for that false statement. So I think that they can be strong if they're consistent and they go with most of the other evidence. Eyewitness statements can be very strong. The problem is that everyone lies, whether it's a man, a woman, a child. It doesn't matter what position they hold, whether they're the leader of a country or whether they're a vagabond. Everyone lies for different reasons, not just in the JFK case, but, you know, I'm sure in every criminal case. That's clouded a lot of the case because people are lying, but not necessarily for the reasons why you think they're lying. You know, people said that those who would think Alan Dulles is ultimately responsible because he started the assassination plots and, you know, think thus he must be responsible for JFK's assassination, that isn't necessarily true. You know, Dulles had a legacy to protect. he, you know, was a rich man who wanted not to live out the rest of his years in infamy based on what people were speculating. And he wanted to protect the agency. So there were a lot of reasons people could lie, and a lot of people did lie. And I think that people who defend the official side want to defend these people who lied, and others want to go after them, but they don't really look at the context of why they were deceptive. And that's my problem with some. I try to balance eyewitnesses against, I say I try to hold them in the court of law, which makes them primary evidence if they go on the record, and then against the court of science, which eyewitnesses are the lowest form of evidence. I will use eyewitnesses, and I have, but they're not going to be the basis of my ideas. Because we can't count on, unless, you know, I mean, memory changes. Memory, you know, from, I'm sure that you've seen stuff and others who have read about, you know, human memory. Memory is sort of like an iceberg. It melts and it refreezes. And it doesn't always refreeze exactly the same way as it was last time. And there are people with, you know, nearly eidetic memories who can keep the same memory consistently, but they're rare. For most people, you're not going to be able to lightning fast bring back that memory with all the details necessary.
Good points. A lot to be said regarding all of these issues, and you've really hit on a number of key issues there, of course, and something that I'm just going to have to hold off on, because I want to shift the focus here to what we have going on in the YouTube chat area, and then kind of shift gears a little bit and the focus over to what we had talked about regarding social media and so forth.
Okay.
We've got about half a dozen people actually joining us here as we stream episode 94 out here live this week, February 17th in Korea. Got the Olympics in pretty much high gear, really. Things really rolling along here, pretty feverish pace. It's something that's really a lot of people have been swept up by, although not everyone, as you can imagine as well. Joe Emanon, of course, as always, it's great to see him. It looks like his chemotherapy he's basically managed to weather the storm and is still with us here in fine fashion, live spirits. So that's something that we're quite pleased to announce. Speaking of acronyms and so forth and cryptographics and whatnot, he actually has a background in the defense field, I believe, as things go. Tell us a little more here via the chat. If he likes, he sometimes does go into things. So I think he's been retired, though, for a number of years. Just to remind people, if you do want to log into YouTube and share some of your thoughts or comments, maybe you've got some questions for Carmine, by all means, there's the possibility you can call in via Skype as well, too, if you like. That's always an option. In the meantime, though, rather than getting sidetracked, because we could go on for quite some time with this JFK thing, and there's a few items that I really like to have addressed as far as your thoughts are concerned, but you are, let's not forget, the author of Two Princes and a King, a concise review of three political assassinations. I believe that covers not only the JFK, but also the RFK murder and Martin Luther King. So the question there, quite simply, maybe you can just address this or summarize things in just 30 seconds or so, but is there a cryptographic angle to any of those murders?
Well, I definitely think cryptonyms are involved. Actually, each of the investigations were given code names. For instance, the Secret Service, JFK Lancer, I believe, was the name for JFK. So there definitely were cryptonyms and code names used throughout not only the Secret Service, the CIA, the FBI. They were involved, and they were involved in intelligence groups that were involved in the cases, because in each of those cases, the CIA and the FBI took interest. In RFK's case, what's interesting is the FBI claimed for a while that it wasn't involved. It was just the Los Angeles Police Department involved. But they were there the day it happened, and they were informed of everything. So,
which leads most people to wonder why they are changing their story. So it doesn't reflect too well on the organization, obviously. It doesn't reflect well on anyone who ends up changing their story, typically. But as far as cryptonyms are concerned, here's one for you. Might find of some significance. Zapata.
Oh, Zapata, yes. That's actually not a cryptonym that I know of. Zapata is one of the claims from Fletcher Prouty, I believe. I know at least in a YouTube video, and I would imagine in his books. Zapata was George Bush's oil company, which is true. but not necessarily for the reasons why Prouty said. Prouty said it was because of an operation that was going on in Cuba that had to do with the Bay of Pigs. But George Bush didn't have anything to do with the Bay of Pigs based on evidence. Based on Prouty's claims, he did. But Zapata was actually an area in Cuba, and Bush had named... Actually, Rob Clark did a show talking about it called Beat the Bushies, where he named his company after a movie they saw where the word Zapata appears in it with his friends, rather than anything to do with that. And Zapata is actually a landmass in Cuba that was famous long before Bush or anybody else used it. So that appears all over the place in operational documents, but it doesn't really necessarily have to do with any sort of cryptonym called Zapata.
Right. It's also the name of one of his boats used in the Bay of Pigs, according to Fletcher Prouty and the like.
Yeah. Well, they said Barbara J was the name of the boat. Actually, it wasn't.
Weren't there two boats?
Yeah, there were two boats. One of them was supposed to be named the Barbara J, and then there was another one he said that was named. But basically, it just didn't pan out to what he claimed. And actually, one of the guys that Prouty talked about a lot later on, when Operation Mongoose, the guy who was in charge at Lansdale, we'll see that Prouty painted him as sort of a clandestine mastermind who was primarily supported by the CIA and was against the Kennedys. But actually, the CIA and a lot of officials didn't like Lansdale, and he was selected by the Kennedys to lead the operation, not the CIA. Because it wasn't controlled by the CIA. Mongoose, a lot of people think Mongoose is directly tied to the assassination plots. It isn't. Mongoose was a multi-agency group that was all under the National Security Council and Robert Kennedy. These things weren't designed the way that they've been portrayed by people in the past, is what I would say a lot of the new documents will show us later. And I'm sorry, we keep going back to JFK, but I'm just trying to answer the question as best I can.
No, that's fine. That's why I asked you the question. Don't worry about it. So let's focus now a little bit, if we could, shifting gears somewhat. Social media and censorship. I know we talked about putting the show together, how you would be comfortable in commenting. So what are your thoughts then? Have you yourself been the target of any censorship? Or what do you, even on top of that, see happening in social media, cross platforms such as Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and the like, as far as censorship is concerned?
Well, unfortunately, I recently was indirectly a target of censorship because a YouTube channel, which was around at least 10 years, probably more. He would know more about it than I would, by Chuck Ocelli, who does the Ocelli Effect that I've been on before, and he's a friend of mine, was terminated. They offered no explanation. They just said that he broke their policy, he violated their policies or standards. He was either posting something too much or it was material that was unacceptable to their guidelines. And they just wiped out 10 years of his shows. It must have been almost 1,000 shows. And I was on at least 60 or so of them. So that's how it affected me. But I feel bad for him because, and what kills me is that his show, you know, like your show and a lot of shows out there, use credible information and they bring on reasonable people. And you're offering, like, you know, tonight, you know, you put out the links and he did that too, where he'd offer the evidence so people could actually check it to see if the person knew what they were talking about and if it was accurate. And that sort of a channel gets wiped out. But you've seen YouTube. There are parts of YouTube that are horrendous, that are just filled with the most unbelievable dreck that a person could put together and slap into a 30-minute video. And, you know, a million people have looked at it and nobody says a thing.
Yeah, it's pretty arbitrary, isn't it? And all done under the guise of community guidelines, typically, is all the only kind of vague, just really meaningless reference that they can come up with as far as justification for, as you say, just deleting or completely, you know, deep sixing somebody's account. Did Chuck not have, he must have had some backup, some archives. I know we do. We have MP3s of pretty much every show that we try to, you know, keep organized here in the event that something like that happens.
Yeah, no, I think he does have backups. I think he has backups of most of it. I don't know if he has backups of the oldest stuff, but it's just, to me anyway, I just think it's crazy because, like you said, it's just some sort of general, I actually looked up a YouTube help forum page. This is, I think, the message that he got. And it says, a lot of people are reporting that they're getting this message. Users are saying, this account has been suspended due to multiple severe violations of YouTube's policy against spam, gaming, misleading content, or other terms of service violations. And that's it.
Oh, yeah. You know what? And Facebook is pretty much the same kind of deal. I'm now on some kind of spam list where every time I try to just share something, anything, a link quite often, maybe the occasional hashtag or whatever, with any kind of content on a friend's timeline or on a page, or I think even some groups that's happening. Well, I'm not sure about that. It's just nuts, man. I get these pop-ups, these notifications that your comment on so-and-so's timeline or page or what have you has been, we're regarding that as spam. You're a spammer. It's like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm only making one comment, and that's spam? What the hell is going on? So they're really doing all they can to put the squeeze on here as far as throttling things down and really restricting our reach, my personal reach, as well as our attempts here via our new fledgling network, WPRPN, to make any gains or inroads as far as wider exposure is concerned. It really has an impact.
To me, it seems almost counterintuitive to think that if they remove channels that are doing well, it's not like, you know, these were the worst channels who weren't bringing them any. I think he was actually making a little bit of money on some of the videos. So there was an incentive for them to keep them. But did they see the word assassination in a lot of his posts? Because we do cover a lot of political assassinations since, you know, like Roman times all the way to current times. Because that word was on everything. Is that spam? It's such a vague and vacuous term. They don't allow you. There's no corrective measures. I think he appealed and he got a response maybe in 5 or 10 minutes, or no, your account's terminated. You can't have it back. So judge, jury, and executioner, basically. And I noticed, I didn't realize at the time that it was probably related to what you were saying about Facebook and what I've noticed on YouTube. But on my Google Plus account, when someone comments something, if they put something down, I guess, that the system doesn't like or the algorithm doesn't like, it just marks them as spam. So that is probably happening to people who are just trying to comment or engage some way because they put something down that the algorithm doesn't like. They're a spammer.
Yeah, that's probably a good part of it. And I think, in addition, my channel has been flagged, my account on Facebook, that is, and that, I guess, maybe people reporting for whatever reason puts you in a special category. The thing about it is that it's just absurd to think, who determines what spam is? And I guess the algorithms do, but one post equals spam in Facebook's eyes. That's beyond me. Maybe 4, 5, or 6, and repeatedly so across, you know, multiple groups. And the thing about it too is we need to promote shows. We need, every time we have something such as what we're putting together here this week, we need to post that link in multiple groups. And what happens is anytime that I do that, even sometimes it's been, I've logged on and in the morning posted a link in maybe 4 or 5 groups and boom, get a notification that your account has been temporarily, certain features or functions have been put on hold for about a week is how things work. I'm not sure. Have you ever been in Facebook jail?
Yeah, I was once. What was it? This was years ago. It's a long story, but there's this guy. This guy named Dave. And Dave, I admin some of the JFK Facebook groups, and Dave liked to come in using fake profiles and basically start fights with people that, you know, because you can't hold them accountable using fake names. So I caught on to what he was doing and was able to actually throw him out 3 different times. And as a result of that, he went through and basically flagged every comment I had made in a bunch of different groups. And like with YouTube, Facebook summarily, you know, they don't take away your account forever like YouTube, so I guess they're better in that way. But yeah, they'll summarily deactivate your ability to say or do anything just based on one person. That's why, you know, I don't only have a problem with the censorship. It's not necessarily direct censorship, but it's passive censorship where now they're trying to adjust everyone's feed to only see the things they want you to see from who they consider your friends and other local people. Because it was fine as it was before. If people want to flag things, that's fine. But the reason I got put in that jail is because he went through to all of my articles and flagged them as offensive and flagged them as, you know, pornographic and a bunch of other things that they weren't. And then finally I sent appeal after appeal and Facebook finally relented. And I said, listen, if you can show me one thing, I'll stop posting. And they couldn't. They just had a bunch of complaints from this person. So,
geez, you think that Facebook or whoever, whatever platform it is, would be intelligent enough that they would be able to understand that someone has an axe to grind. There's a vendetta in place. You know, speaking of which, have you heard of Minds.com?
Minds.com? No.
Well, you have now, so you might be interested in checking it out. It's censorship-free. The hashtag system they have in place is pretty decent. Some little quirks to it. But it's open-sourced, and the private messaging is encrypted, so it makes the bastards work a little harder, you know, if they want to intrude on people's private conversations. Whereas with Facebook, of course, from what I understand, it's pretty much...
Oh, they know.
Well, yeah, I mean, the CIA apparently played a really major role in the second round of funding, is how the story goes. So they were right there, Johnny on the spot. So it's CIA book more than anything, from what I understand.
Yeah, well, no matter what, the NSA is going to get it. So,
well, the encryption, like I said,
PRISM is still operational.
Encryption just makes them work a little harder. That's all. Rather than just freely handing everything without even doing their jobs by the Unpatriot Act, as I like to refer to it, frankly, the way that things work right now and the impact that's had on so many people's lives where they've been detained or arrested. I've heard stories from friends, for example, where police have used the Unpatriot Act to make their life a living hell. And that's what they've said. Well, we got the Unpatriot Act now, so it gives us the power to do this. I think this one friend, it was simple pot possession somewhere down in Southern Carolina, I believe, or something along those lines. But that's what the cop said. He used that as justification, and I believe he spent a little time in jail and having to go to court. I'm not sure. Have you heard any other stories along those lines as far as the Unpatriot Act is concerned?
I haven't heard of anyone getting directly affected by it, but I know, and I would recommend to anyone who's listening to fight that in court, because the bottom line is the Patriot Act is unconstitutional, and the Constitution legally is considered a Leviathan document, which means it cannot be overcome legally. I would make them come into court, and if they want their Patriot Act, defend it. Say that they should have these rights, these illegal rights that violate the Constitution, you know, in the case you were referring to, a possession of pot, which seems wholly ridiculous. I'm upset that more people, I talk about that people need to stand up to the Patriot Act because it is illegal. It's not a real law. It's a power. It's a power they're claiming to have, and they only have it if we don't stand up to it.
Seems to be written pretty much along the same sort of lines as to what Hitler's Enabling Act was, the same sort of spirit and character with the same powers, really.
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot of corrupt, tyrannical regimes that have attempted to do the same thing. I have no doubt of that. The bottom line is that they cannot enforce that legally, and they know they can't.
Trump recently?
They have to rely.
Did you hear about that in the news? In fact, it was just a couple weeks ago, I believe. Trump, he extended this business of warrantless wiretapping, I believe is how it works. Do you know what you're...
With the FISA courts.
Yeah, what's the deal there exactly?
Well, the FISA courts are a specialized, basically, a court for clandestine operations and things, so officials don't have to go before a public grand jury or go before the public and say that they want to do this. They can just go to a judge from the FISA court and get them to sign off on everything rather than having to go through the normal process of warrants and the law.
That's a whole can of worms, isn't it? And I think that violates habeas corpus, does it not?
Well, I know parts of the Patriot Act do, definitely. Depending on the ruling with the judge, it might, but I know the parts of the Patriot Act do because, even the right to privacy. There's so many just basic constitutional protections, things in the Patriot Act supersede. And another thing that people don't really think about, there is all the powers that they try to claim, which are a problem, but the cost, because it's basically been a blank check since 2001. The creation of Homeland Security, which was wholly unnecessary. They could have just expanded the FBI and the other existing agencies we already had. They didn't need to create another cabinet position and then, another layer of redundant officials to serve under that cabinet position. So to me, it was sort of a money grab, too. It wasn't just a power grab.
Looks like you got a few fans here in the house. Emily Anderson saying, I like this guy. Big smiles. As well as Delacroix. Qua, welcome aboard. Good to see you dropping by. He sometimes has made his presence known. So it is you people, of course, out there that do drop in and listen to the shows that we stream out every week live at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. 11 p.m. Eastern, I guess, is how things work here. It's kind of a little tricky with the... It's a world... operation, obviously. So as far as the times are concerned, it's not the easiest thing to calculate. Kind of surreal, really, the way we're in fact living in the future over here. But it is the people, the listeners that tune in every week who do make the show. So thanks once again, everyone who you know, has shown their support by dropping by. Keep those questions coming in, or thoughts, comments, what have you, via the YouTube here. If you have them, Joe Kennedy, Ode Film and TV, and the day, I guess it's, is it Ode or Owned? Ergo, two of his sins died on film. There's some spelling issues, maybe they're Delacroix. Maybe a little bit of a cryptographic wordplay, or who knows exactly, just having fun with the spelling. So let's see where we can take things from here. I'm not sure if you want to talk any more about the censorship or social media. Maybe we can come back to that a little more. Another fan that you've got, actually, too, is Joe Pyatt, who I'm not sure if you know him personally or not, Carmine, but he actually is a big fan of the Ocelli Effect, and I guess has heard you there, as well as maybe a couple of other places, but he had nothing but great things to say about you. So
thanks, Joe. Thank you to all three of the listeners, Amber and Delacroix, too. Thank you.
Yeah, now, if I'm not sure how many of them have actually bought your book or not, but do you offer signed copies, perchance?
No, I don't, because I had to sort of create everything myself. I didn't have the ability, but it could be possible. If people wanted to send it to me, as long as they wouldn't mind covering postage, I wouldn't mind sending it back to them and signing it for them if they're interested in that.
That'd be a pretty dedicated fan.
I've had a couple.
Sure, yeah. It looks like a real great book, for sure. So we'll definitely have to make that more readily available to people via the show notes with links and whatnot. Well, let's see where we can take things from here. Speaking of Mary Farrell, although that is kind of taking things back to the JFK, that whole realm, Christopher Hitchens was one of the names that we had taken note of here, just, I guess, having looked at your Facebook account. I guess you were a fan of his. That, of course, yeah. I guess, ties in somewhat to this, the rigid skepticism, skeptical way of just looking at the world and existence, I suppose. What in particular was it about Hitchens that appealed to you?
Well, what's funny is that I and Hitchens disagree on a lot of political issues. I don't necessarily agree with everything he thought politically, but I think that his thinking was probably among some of the best of the generation before me. And I think that he evolved, which I think is definitely a mark of a good thinker, is that you evolve as you experience new things. There's an evolution to your ideas, which is important. I think a lot of people, they get stuck with the same idea and they want to keep pushing that idea. And that no matter what sort of an investigation or activity you're involved in, we always should be evolving our ideas to go with whatever new facts we learn. I could appreciate that Hitchens did that. And I like that Hitchens stood up to the face of unrecognizable hatred that was certain religions throughout history. Personally, like I told you earlier off the air, or no, on the air, when you were talking about the panel, I am an atheist, but I think everyone has the right to believe whatever they want. As long as they don't impede on other people, it's when people try to enforce religion or try, and it doesn't even have to be religion, when they try to enforce their belief system, no matter whether it's secular or not, on other people against their will, that to me, there's a problem. It's unjust and it's unacceptable. And that was something that I really supported Hitchens on. You know, I appreciated his speaking tours, all the threats he got. And he kept doing it, you know, up until he died. I've noticed, too, something that annoyed me that I've always wanted to cover. You know, I haven't done a lot of shows where I talked about religion, but I even noticed that some authors tried to say, what you see with the death of any great thinker, when they die, people try to then adopt them for their cause. So there were actually religious people trying to say that Hitchens was converted on his deathbed, like the same story they made about Charles Darwin and Einstein and lots of great thinkers, which is not true. But I can appreciate why they'd want to take him for their cause. But yeah, I'd say that he's one of the people I tried to, you know, I read a lot of what Hitchens wrote. He's one of the more modern people I tried to rely on. I also, you know, try to go as far back as, you know, I'm sure many do, you know, Socrates, Plato. I know he's not a very popular person, but I think that his skepticism was impeccable. I'm a big fan of the writings of Machiavelli because he's a lot more honest in his discussion of how politics goes than most people are currently. A lot of people, it seems to me, are so dead set on their current political beliefs and, you know, opposing those who disagree with them, but there's no room for evolution. So it's basically just both sides pushing at each other and no one ever makes any progress. No one ever changes their ideas. You know, nothing goes forward because they're just in this intractable battle where it's not reason they're relying on, it's their feelings.
Machiavelli and the ends justifying the means. Anything other than The Prince that you've read?
Yeah, The Discourses of Livy was a good one by him. He wrote a play called Mandragola that was pretty good. I tried to have read everything that I could get my hands on, yeah, with Machiavelli. As I said, I'm not saying he was a good person, because obviously from some of the things that he undertook in his life and the things he commented on, he wasn't a good person. But he had a sound judgment in his ideas, and you see them play out over and over again. Unfortunately, when we put power in the hands of someone, man or woman, you know, despite some of the modern beliefs that men are usually the oppressors, power in the hands of anyone is dangerous. And if you put power for too long in the hands of anyone, they're going to abuse it. And that's basically the overall general thing I learned from Machiavelli.
Yeah, isn't there an expression that runs somewhere along the lines of, if you want to see someone's true character, give them a little power. And that's where you'll see their real character emerge.
One of the things that actually that reminds me of is something Hitchens said. A good man does good things, a bad man does bad things. But it takes religion to get a good man to do bad things. So, indeed, if you have power over someone, you can make them do unspeakable things that they'd never consider doing of their own volition. So that's, to me, the danger. Yeah, one of the big dangers, you know, because that, essentially that is what religion is you are relenting to an unseen power that you really can't quantify, and you're living your life. People always say, well, what if you're wrong? You know, the Pascal's wager. What if you're wrong and then, you know, you get punished? Well, if this is a supreme being, if this is an omnipotent being who knows everything, they should know that I was going to be skeptical without any proof. I was made that way. I require evidence. If you don't have evidence, then I don't believe it.
Voltaire is one of the names that's come to mind here. I believe it was his quote, quite famously, just with regards to this business of power and character. I can't find it at the present moment. Do you perhaps, just off the top of your head, know what I might be talking about?
No, I don't know the power quote. The one of his I always think of is, I disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it.
Yes, and here's, go ahead.
Another one I think that really is absent from current, you know, I'm sure, you know, you see it over in Korea and it's all over the world. You know, I see it from my vantage point in the U.S., but I just see that people being so unreasonable, you know, for emotional reasons and not wanting to.
And this goes right back to what we're talking about earlier about censorship, social media and whatnot. The number of groups that I've been banned from on Facebook is ridiculous, and for nothing more than just speaking the truth as I see it, you know, not using any profanity, not issuing any threats, just trying to keep rational, using as much reason as I can possibly manage and muster with the little bit of background and training that I do have, or exposure at least, with respect and within the context of simple logical fallacies, ad hominem attacks, things like the false dilemma kind of nonsense, and post hoc ergo propter hoc, nice little Latin, after this, therefore, because of that, simple things like that. And then people just don't like to have their bubbles burst, I guess is what it is. And hot topic buttons such as Israel, that's a big one. That got me banned from a few places, having the politically incorrect view or position there, as well as things like man-made CO2-based climate change. It's quite a mouthful, folks, if you want to deconstruct that one. But I think you might get the idea. Another one is the Asia Institute. That kind of irks me, and I have not heard back from those SOBs at all. You know, I really wonder, speaking of the CIA and so forth, I really strongly suspect they might be some sort of front group. You know, there is obviously quite a long-standing history of the company, I guess, is the CIA is often referred to as, with them having these front groups, shell companies or what have you. So the Asia Institute is definitely, they're on my radar here now, big time, the ship's radar. So I'm not sure what the captain has to say about all this, but
I believe the word the CIA uses for them is proprietaries.
Oh, God. Jeez.
One that comes to mind is it was called the Wackenhut Corporation.
The military-industrial complex and, you know, the private prison industry, really. The Bush Crime Syndicate, or some people as they refer to it, Bush-Clinton Crime Syndicate. Those two seem to work together and have done so for quite a few years, hand in glove. But a lot of people talk about the drugs. A lot of people talk about the arms. A lot of people talk about the oil. But really, I guess their top investment is none other than these private for-profit prisons, locking people up, taking their liberty away, and throwing them in jail for things like simple, once again, marijuana possession.
Yeah, Wack and Hut was just one of the many, you know, proprietaries that I've read over the years that they used. But one of the interesting things about the CIA, and to a lesser degree some of the other alphabet agencies, as they're often referred to, is, you know, they operate largely with clandestine budgets, drawing their money from other departments of the government under cover of different activities. So that was actually one of the challenges that in the 1970s, when congressional committees were looking into the CIA, the Pike Committee, who was actually trying to find out their budget, couldn't get it. Even from the regulators who were supposed to have gone over the budget and seen it, no one could locate the mysterious CIA budget and how the money was transferred and where it went. So effectively, they couldn't account for everything that they were spending. And as we know, you know, various programs that have been exposed over the years that had to do with Vietnam and other areas where drug smuggling was going on and illegal activities were going on and assassinations were going on and money was changing hands, but there's no record. But you'd be surprised some of the things they do make records of, especially in the assassination arena.
Such as, before I forget, question, has the company ever been audited? The Federal Reserve, same people talk about that. Where is the Federal Reserve audit? Ron Paul's been calling for it for quite a few years now. What of the CIA?
I highly doubt there's ever been an extensive, maybe an internal one, but I don't think it's made into any of the documents that are yet public. And it's huge numbers. I mean, just from, I remember reading one document that had to do with, in the early 60s, they created these autonomous groups because basically they realized after the Bay of Pigs and other failures that, you know, they didn't want direct connections to the U.S. So they were funding these large exile groups in other countries operating outside of the U.S. so they couldn't be directly linked back to them. Just for one of these groups, they were funding, I believe it was to the tune of, it was in the tens of millions. And that's just one group.
Yeah, John Kennedy, too, going back to the whole JFK legacy, really, and era, one of the things that he's on the record as having stated is that he wanted nothing more than to see the CIA splintered into 1,000 pieces and thrown to the wind.
I believe it was one of his advisors who said that. I think that that might have been true at the moment, but I think that he probably realized that couldn't happen, because even if you did destroy the CIA like they had destroyed the OSS, those people largely, you weren't going to get rid of all of them. They'd go to other government departments and other agencies and probably hold a grudge from there. So I think that he wanted to reform the CIA, more likely.
Right.
I mean, maybe he did want to destroy it, but it wasn't probably going to happen. Largely people think that presidents have a lot more power than they do, because while they are, you know, commander-in-chief of the army and they are the titular head of the government, in my opinion, it's really a lot of middle managers that end up implementing the big decisions of government because they're there for 10, 20, 30 years, as where a president only gets 4 or 8.
Absolutely. You know, Alan Dulles, he was fired by Kennedy, but apparently, what's the point when he actually ended up serving out his term, essentially, right up to the point of Kennedy being killed, he still had not left his position. Is that not the case?
Dulles was out, I think it was 61, but the thing is that people say he was fired. He actually resigned. You know, I understand there's not a big difference in the effect afterwards. He is out of the job. But Kennedy actually gave him an award before he resigned. And then he resigned. I think that they were giving him the chance to hold on to his dignity and that he was going to pay for the Bay of Pigs. But I don't think it was the big surprise that some people try to make it. I think Dulles realized, all the people that got fired realized, that there was going to be a political cost and there was no way the president was going to let himself pay it. So it was going to have to be some of the leaders of this errant mission that were going to have to pay the political cost. And with Dulles, people try to say that him firing Kennedy was a reason why, being fired by Kennedy, I should say, is a reason for him wanting to get revenge. But once again, like I said earlier, Alan Dulles was going to be a rich man till the day he died. And Alan Dulles had a huge legacy that he and his brother John Foster Dulles had been basically building for over a decade. So I don't think that he was going to risk all that on the odd chance the plot might work. It's possible. I just see him as a long-term thinker, and I don't think – now, if you go down a few steps, I might start to agree that there are middle managers who are – like William Harvey, for instance, to me would be a lot more likely of a possible suspect than Alan Dulles, because Harvey was a drunk. He had a dying intelligence career because he had screwed up during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was on the outs with most of the people, and he couldn't stand the Kennedys because he had lost a lot of positions because he screwed up and they got rid of him. He maintained a relationship with Johnny Roselli, the mobster that was used in the assassination plots Harvey was in charge of earlier, until they both died. So to me, that's the sort of a guy who I could see having a hand, perhaps, or even instructing others outside of an agency how to do something, and then they did it.
or all of the above. Why need it be mutually exclusive? It could, you know, because I don't think Dulles shed any tears following the death of Kennedy. In fact, even people, characters like Hoover, it said, took some great delight in delivering the message to Robert Kennedy that his brother had been murdered.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. There was definitely, the Kennedys were contentious people. I think, unfortunately, sometimes people, you know, they try to either deify or villainize these people, and I don't think that always plays out when you look at a lot of the facts, because as much as, you know, Robert Kennedy, I think, was a great man and was, you know, inspired and wise at the end of his life, and, it, you know, it was such a tragic loss that he was taken, in his early years, he was kind of ambitious, and he did make a lot of enemies for his brother because he was so young and inexperienced and, you know, tried to assert his leadership. For instance, Hoover had created the FBI. Hoover had endowed it with all these powers and monies, you know, over the decades as he built up the stature and the power of the FBI. Then JFK comes into office and appoints his younger brother to be in charge of Hoover. I'm not saying that it justifies the tactics Hoover used. I'm just saying that it's a person. If you let this person who's had power for so long allowed to do whatever he wanted largely, and then he is clamped down by a younger person, they're probably going to resent that. I think there were reasons for the resentments that don't necessarily lead them to wanting to assassinate JFK. And I just think that some people, unfortunately, take just that base, you know, understanding of, okay, well, he was mad at him, so he'd want to kill him, which doesn't always play out, I don't think.
The claim has been made. I'm not sure how exactly it'd be verified, but supposedly, what was it, something like 50 years, I guess, Hoover sat at the helm of the FBI.
5 decades.
Yeah, and there was not a single individual, supposedly, who ever received a promotion who was not a Freemason. You had to be a Freemason in order to get a leg up, as it were, and have your career advance.
I definitely want to see the evidence on that, because I think that's probably improbable.
Something you'll have to research now if you're interested.
Yeah, I'll check.
So,
yeah, no, I'll have to check it out.
A couple things regarding, going back to Dulles here, and I guess we're shifting our focus once again back to JFK. We've only got really about half an hour left. How time flies when you're having fun here on the Robin Hood, episode 94, folks, of Pirate Radio Podcast, with our special weekly feature guest, Carmine. Savastano, I believe, is how you pronounce the last name. I was struggling with that the whole past week here because it's not too many Italian names that I'm really all that familiar with. And we were talking once again about, just before we did go live, you are of Italian descent, although I guess you're, is it your mother is Irish and your father Italian?
Yeah.
So, and did you grow up in the Michigan area or not?
Yeah. I was actually born and raised not too far from where I live now.
How about that?
So,
Well, a couple of things. One, just going back to Dulles for a moment, and then just a little something regarding university culture. Are you familiar with the story regarding how Dulles approached Truman after the former president had written a letter stating that one of his biggest regrets was in signing, I think it was the National Security Act, which in turn, as a part of that, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert here, of course, but the CIA was born, essentially, that it came from out of the National Security Act. Anyways, however things played out, that Truman apparently had written this letter, an editorial of sorts, taking the position. It was among his life's greatest regrets. Dulles visited him a little after this letter appeared in a newspaper or two throughout the states. I'm not sure how widely it was distributed, what sort of exposure it picked up. And he tried to persuade him into retracting his comments. The president decided not to and held fast with the opinions that he had laid out. Dulles then, I guess, turned around, went home, and tried to, in some way, make out as if, and kind of, it's like a smear campaign, really, is what he launched, supposedly, to portray Truman as an old, feeble, senile man. And that basically, oh, well, he's just crazy, so what does he know, kind of thing. Have you ever heard that story?
Yeah, I heard a little bit about it, but while we were talking, I looked up a U.S. News article that's about it, and it does have President Truman, December 22nd, 1963, saying that the CIA's role needed to be limited to intelligence. A month after the assassination of President Kennedy, 10 years before the Church Committee, but Truman said that there is something about the way the CIA has been functioning that is casting a shadow over our historic position, and I feel that we need to correct it. I agree. I don't think it's just the CIA either. I think by now there's multiple agencies.
Some that most people haven't even heard of, from what I understand.
Yeah, like the NSA. The NSA, I think it was up until the 80s, was known as no such agency because most people didn't know it existed.
Yeah, and it goes even further than that, apparently, too, with shadow organizations. So, well, let's see now. The Devil's Chessboard, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about here. I'm not too clear on the author's name. I do have the book around here somewhere. It can be found in the ship's library. But, one of the things... I was in university back in Canada in the mid-90s. One of my professors, he was a professor, in fact, of Chinese anthropology. That was quite a course. I really enjoyed myself learning a lot about classical, ancient Chinese history, culture, and whatnot, with all the religions and so forth. But one of the things that he actually made clear, presented to the class, was how he had, in fact, been a CIA agent of sorts. I don't even think... because he was more than an asset, an actual agent who lived in China for a number of years. And his daily routine was to keep watch on and basically follow what was being published in the newspapers and then report back to the West, providing maybe even any analysis or what have you. But the thing that he made clear on top of that was that universities are a ripe breeding ground, or should I say maybe... the environment for recruiting into the CIA is where a lot of people find themselves attending university, plucked out of these institutions and offered jobs within the organization, the company, I guess, once again, as it's known. And one of the reasons that they do this, and mostly who they focus on, are people such as yourself who are able to research and basically collate data, access files and information and so on and so forth, if you follow what I'm getting at. Have you yourself ever been approached by anyone that you've known of in a formal sense?
No, I've never been. You're actually, I think, the first person. I have been asked if I was a communist once. And I said, no, I'm not. I don't really have any political parties that I ascribe to. But yeah, no, I've never been approached, but I remember in college, there was one of my instructors told me that they had been approached when she told me that, she told me she was approached while she was in college in Ohio, I believe, and that it's fairly common that they would come in and basically say, you know, they were having like a free movie or whatever, and it would just be some strange, weird movie, and there'd be someone that would be there. They'd see the reactions. Some people get up and leave and get bored or whatever, and whoever was left at the end of it, those are the people they would talk to because they had actually sat there and endured this ridiculous movie until the end when they would talk to them afterwards. And she said she ended up not taking it, but... it makes total sense to me. I mean, that's the age, kind of like the military. That's the age when you are young and impressionable, and you might be interested in something like that. And if you have the skills that they want, then yeah, it makes total sense. Unfortunately, I was going to say, though, that in some debates, people like to accuse, I myself, and I'm sure almost all of my friends and other researchers in the community that I've talked to, have been accused of working for some government agency because you say something they don't like. And unfortunately, like those emotional arguments we were talking about earlier, that's where that comes from. Is it's a lot easier just to, you know, make some ridiculous claim that they can't prove rather than face the fact of they're probably wrong.
Yale, I guess, is one of the prime recruiting grounds or institutions. A lot of people over the years have been plucked from out of that school, basically, offered jobs and presumably taken them in many cases. Skull and Bones, of course, the... quite notorious secret quasi-Masonic organization that has been widely talked about in the, well, not the news so much as just pop culture. There's even a movie, I think, called Skulls mm-hmm. that was made a number of years ago that attempted to portray or, you know, reveal some of the secrets. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, and once in a while that does happen. You know, you'll get a movie like The Good Shepherd, the movie with Robert De Niro, or you'll get, to a lesser extent, the James Bond movies, because those are more flash and, you know, but some of the tradecraft isn't totally off. They do follow certain patterns that are actually used in intelligence operations. but, you know, minus a lot of the Hollywood spectacle.
The Good Shepherd and JFK by Oliver Stone. Let's just talk about those two movies for the next couple minutes. And then I'd like to ask you a little bit about Operation Mockingbird. We had John Barber on here a couple of months ago, and he really hit it out of the park, basically visiting us to showcase and talk about his recent documentary regarding the assassination, and particular the media's complicity. Shouldn't use words you're not able to pronounce or don't know the meaning of, but the media's role basically in helping to, well, they really didn't, they kind of dropped the ball basically and just went along with the official narrative and didn't really work as hard as they could have perhaps in exposing these alleged conspirators. So, you know, who knows? Maybe some even ended up paying with their lives. I know going back to the Warren Commission, because it's a central part of the whole assassination and the way that it was, you know, they attempted, I guess, in some ways at least, to track down the killers. So many of the witnesses were completely ignored. So many of the people in Dealey Plaza that were there on the ground, they were never invited or asked to testify. So what are your thoughts on that? What does that say of how does that impact the legitimacy of the Warren Commission?
Well, I think that it definitely has an impact on it. You know, I, like I'm sure many others have done, try to compile as accurate of a list as possible. And even the list we can put together from the people that can be verified that were there, you know, is over 300. You know, when it's into the hundreds, and chances are they might have gotten half, maybe two thirds of the people, you know, accounted for as a, you know, numeric value. But if you look at the commission, of the some 500 plus witnesses that they have, most of them are just character witnesses. Or experts or officials. They're not eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses, I think, ranges less than 200 actual eyewitnesses. So that's maybe a third of the total people that could have been in Dealey Plaza. Let's say 400 to 600. That's pretty conservative. Some people try to go higher than that, but I'd say 400 to 600 is a reasonable number. So yeah, they basically let half the witness pool or more walk away. I mean, people left the area, which is why not only is it the possibility is reasonable that another person could have been involved and they got away, and that there were people that could have seen things that never made it into the official record because they were allowed to leave. Because honestly, the Dallas Police Department, you know, a lot of people try to say it's always nefarious. I think a lot of what the Dallas Police Department did was bad police work, and it was incompetence. There was actually people trying to change things and cover things up, but I don't think it was because they were part of any larger conspiracy. I think that they were trying to. Steve Rowe, who is a friend of mine, calls it CYA mode, cover your ass. That's what they were trying to do. They didn't want to be blamed, which eventually they were, for the investigation falling apart and then the FBI trying to put the pieces back together. And much like Humpty Dumpty, you know, the things couldn't be reassembled to be as they should have. Among the mistakes, not only was letting the witnesses go, they didn't secure the crime scene. You know, there were reporters walking through that place. They didn't lock it down. People were able, they found, you know, the leftover when the flashbulb was expended from cameras strewn about the place and boxes moved around when they went back the next day. So the crime scene was violated. Nothing was kept in the way that it should have been. You know, then they lost the suspect a few days later, even though they were warned multiple times by the FBI and there were threats called in that someone was going to do something to Oswald. So, yeah, I mean, and that's just, you know, the beginning. We actually, if you or people want to check it out, you can find it. I hope you don't mind if I plug one website real quick, Ocelli.com, because you can't find them on YouTube, unfortunately, anymore. So please go to Ocelli.com. There's a series, the JFK 101, and we try to break down piece by piece all of these investigations and where they failed. And I think a lot of times people are looking for, you know, a nefarious reason, but a lot of times they didn't know what the hell they were doing, or they were so overcome by the amount of public interest and the scrutiny that they were receiving, they weren't prepared to do what needed to be done, unfortunately. And you know, in that sort of a confusing environment, people are going to guess at why certain things happen. And a lot of times that's just going to be speculation, and it just adds more confusion to the already existing confusion.
What of the possibility or intimidation is always something to consider as well, too. People who not only you could fear for your life, I suppose, but also just your job. Keep your mouth shut and toe the party line. here, and everything will just
definitely work out
fine. So, I mean, I'm not sure if you really addressed that or not. You're talking, trying to emphasize more the incompetence end of things, but I mean, intimidation would be a major factor. Hey, let's not forget the Trump dump. And I'd like to know your thoughts just briefly here, and time is running short, but on Trump, if he had much of a, with his decisions that were made and his signing off on whatever measures he felt were necessary and that should be taken, how much credit he should be given for what we've seen happen here and shaking things up with these documents coming to light, some of them still kept, I guess, under wraps and out and away from public scrutiny, I guess for two reasons, mainly because some of these people are alive, characters such as possibly George H.W. Bush. I'm not sure if Ted Cruz's father is, but that played into things in the lead up to the election, I believe. And secondly, always the good old national security. When all else fails, play the national security card to get your way. But Hoover, basically, that's one of the things that we did find, and you can address any of these as you like, including Trump's role and in things and how much credit he should or should not be given. But Hoover, I guess, that's one of the things that came out with the recent revelations, is that he had basically stated that, once again, for the record, I believe, we need to pin this on Oswald, whatever it takes.
Well, yeah, I think originally something that, you know, a lot of people that doesn't get mentioned very often is people always say that, you know, the commission was, you know, the tool of Johnson, the commission served Johnson, and it was what he always wanted, and it was in his control. Well, actually, the commission, if Johnson would have gotten his way, would have never existed. Originally, Johnson wanted J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI to lead the only investigation, and then it wouldn't have been made public either. There would have been a report. It would have gone to who it was allowed to go to. They might have made some details public, but we actually should be happy. As much as the Warren Commission was a travesty of justice, as much as incompetence was everywhere and there were biased people running a lot of it, we should be happy that the commission happened, because it gave us a hell of a lot more evidence to look at and dispute. Because if this just would have been an FBI investigation, it would have been filed at the FBI headquarters, given to the president and whoever he deemed necessary, and that was it. We wouldn't know anything. It'd be kind of like the 9/11 commission report without the report. This is what happened. We've decided everything's okay. You guys go about your business. It was the original idea. The commission actually happened because Robert Kennedy and other people started leaking things to the press and using their influence to get this to be expanded to a more national body. So it wasn't. And at the same time, the state of Texas was trying to launch its own investigation. So there were multiple investigations launching all over the place and people trying to claim jurisdiction, because one of the big problems was at the time, the reason why the FBI shouldn't have been in the leadership role that it played throughout this and shouldn't have been the investigator for the commission is the FBI was acting outside of its jurisdiction basically throughout all the beginning of this until Congress passed a special law that gave the commission jurisdiction over the matter, and then they relegated it to the FBI as their investigative arm.
Alan Dulles, too, once again, correct me if I'm wrong, did he not famously state that with respect to the investigation, he did not want America to be viewed within the eyes of the world as some banana republic, basically, was the term or phrase that he used. Some people have talked about, too, how it was Judge Warren who headed things, but really it was Dulles who pulled the strings and really called the shots kind of, you know, from behind the scenes. He was a part of things, I believe, the commission, but he really was the decision maker and had the most influence in things.
Influence, perhaps. I might agree with them on that he probably had the most influence to wield out of anybody. I don't necessarily think he was the mastermind or pulled the strings. He might have tried. In some instances, yeah, he did actually try, because he wanted to. I remember reading one of the executive reports where they talked about that Dulles wanted to get everything over to the CIA, and Commissioner Russell said, why? They'll just doctor anything you hand them. So that's another thing. The commission was split. You know, as much as Warren tried to enforce unanimity of everyone together, it wasn't that way, really, when you look into the, you know, the background of the meetings they had privately. I'd say Russell, Sherman Cooper, and Boggs were usually always against what Dulles and Warren and the more conservative members wanted to do. So there was definitely things going on, but Warren demanded that it be unanimous in the public version to sort of, you know, make it look like they all agreed, when they didn't. Afterwards, you even had LBJ and other people coming out saying that they think there was more to be investigated and that there was a conspiracy.
Speaking of conspiracies or just coincidence, there is Boggs, for whatever reason, later dying in a plane crash, along with, I believe, as an Alaskan senator, would that be like in the mid-70s? And there was some, the plane and wreckage, the body's never been found. Who was the, he's the scientist of sorts, Begich, I believe is the name. There we go. His father went down with Boggs. Do you know who is said to have driven Boggs to the airport that day to catch his flight to the fishing trip in Alaska?
No. No, I know about the story, but yeah, no, I've never really looked into it
Bill much. Bill Clinton. William Jefferson Clinton.
That's interesting. If it's, have you seen, yeah, you'll have to send that to me. I'll have to have a look at it.
A lot of people have talked about that. So I guess, yeah, hashtag fact check, as always.
Indeed.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Not really taking any notes here, just trying to keep everything straightened away as we carry along here. But the House Select Committee on Assassinations in, was it 1977? They did find, I believe, their conclusion was that there was reason to think there was a conspiracy, correct?
Yes, that was their conclusion. Now, the argument you're going to hear about that with people is those who support that it wasn't a conspiracy bring up that a lot of the acoustical findings were dismissed because of later science that occurred to where it showed that there were problems with that. And then they say, because the acoustics were dismissed, it's not a conspiracy. And then on the other side, you'll have people who say, well, it doesn't matter what these new things are saying. The original findings are the most important. So it was a conspiracy and these prove it was a conspiracy. Now, the reality of the situation is it doesn't prove either. Just because the acoustics got thrown out doesn't rescind the rest of the case. One of the things I was going to go into, you know, hopefully if you want to have me back, we can go into it deeper. But one of the things I found in the new documents was Patricia Johnson McMillan, who was an author who painted Oswald as an angry young man and spent time, lived with Morena to get as much information as she could before she put out her book later, Morena and Lee. I actually found a document that verifies that she was a contact and a source of the CIA. And that was suggested for years by people, but no one had ever come across that piece of evidence that shows it. And I was happy and lucky enough to come across it when I was doing some of my research into the new files. Basically, what that adds to the Oswald picture is that we have Oswald now going in his alleged defection to Russia in 1959. He, on Halloween Day, shows up at the U.S. Embassy and puts on a costume, I would say, of being a Marxist. Goes into the embassy and just happens to interact with the second secretary, who is Richard Schneider. Schneider is a CIA employee under State Department cover. Someone then suggests to a local journalist who is staying at a local hotel, just by chance the same hotel Oswald's staying in, who is a contact. Patricia Johnson McMillan is who the person the council hands Oswald off to so that she can do an expose on him. Now, I suppose someone could say that's all a coincidence, but apparently, how many CIA-connected people does he have to be handed off to until we can say that there's probably a chance he might be involved in an intelligence operation, witting or unwitting? Because, you know, that, of course, isn't the end. The CIA followed his mail for years in the HT-lingual program. He was, you know, followed by FBI agents all over the United States when he returned. Just that he was able to come back, to me, is one of the most telling things about a likely connection of some sort, whether he knew or not, to an intelligence group. Because how many people could defect, go to Russia, get all of the treatment that he got in Russia, have a child in Russia, and then during one of the heightened parts of the Cold War, take his Soviet bride and his new child and come back to the United States on a State Department loan when he had threatened to basically breach national security by revealing all of his secrets in 59. And, you know, that's another thing. In 59, when he went to the embassy and he turned over his passport to Schneider and says, I want to give up my citizenship, Snyder didn't process his request. He just put his passport in his desk and said, come back after the weekend after you think about it a little bit and let me know. And Oswald doesn't come back for almost 2 years, and it still sits in Snyder's desk, and Snyder just hands it back to him. It's also ridiculous
that could occur. No, that's a great point and something that people obviously need to, as you've done, think about, because it's not just everybody that gets that sort of kid glove treatment. Basically, real smooth back and forth across borders, especially, as you say, during the height of the Cold War. And the one coincidence stacked onto the next, adding up more and more, you know, to the point where people do. I mean, you can't help but wonder, like, what's going on and where do we draw the line here as far as coincidences? And it makes you more inclined, I guess, to be thinking along the lines of, yeah, there being a conspiracy, whatever you happen to be looking at, whether it's JFK, September 11th, Princess Diana, you name it. So, okay, we're winding things down here, though, too. So let's, before we call it a night, just hit on a couple other quick points here. You know, we did mention our guest that we had join us a couple months ago, John Barber, and he was talking, you know, about his documentary film and its emphasis, focus on Operation Mockingbird, something which the CIA, of course, you know, wanted to keep under wraps for as long as possible. It now seems to have come to light, and really, I guess anyone that's heard of it can't help but think or wonder how many people presently find themselves embedded within establishment media, people such as the likes of Anderson Cooper. He has quite a backstory, I guess heir to the Vanderbilt fortune as well, too, as things would have it. But yeah, quite a few, quite replete, systemic, and quite institutional as far as how many people do you think are CIA assets of sorts embedded within American establishment media?
Well, I would not dismiss, you know, I think that it's, I don't think it would be reasonable to say there's none. I don't think that there's tens of thousands, but if, you know, I were to venture a guess, you know, I'd say between hundreds and thousands, maybe low thousands or high hundreds, because you got to figure how many dozens of various media corporations and then how many dozens of smaller media groups until you get all the way down to, you know, one, two people operations. And the agency has an interest in being able to affect its propaganda. Every nation, whether people want to admit it or not, is engaging in some sort of propaganda, state institutionalized propaganda. You know, in a place like North Korea, it's going to be fairly high. Maybe 80, 90% of the media is state run. And places like Russia, you know, places that are more overtly influential in wielding their power, you know, wielding their power to influence the media. And you got to think it's worldwide because they're not just going to have propaganda assets in the U.S. They're going to have propaganda assets overseas as well. And that's always been part of
big time. And you say you mentioned North Korea. Well, South Korea, I would say, is really not that different, frankly, the way that they have these so-called chaebols here, which are these corporate conglomerates. It's textbook fascism, folks, is what we're living under on a world scale, frankly. That's all fascism is corporatism. And, you know, we find that quite heavily. Corporatism is, it's clear across the board, of course, with all these multilateral international agreements and things like, well, thank God he canceled it the first day of office. That was quite a symbolic, if anything, just purely for that reason, gesture. President Trump nullifying the TPP. I guess now there are certain powers in various countries that are trying to have that agreement basically put back into place or brought back to life in some fashion. So, yeah, South Korea, not much different. And once again, the CIA, their mandate is an overseas foreign one. So you can believe that they are quite active in nations such as where I presently find myself, along with any other Asian country, too. Oh, the Five Eyes was one of the things I was going to ask you about just briefly, what you can say or if you can perhaps comment. But let me just say Operation Mockingbird, what we got here is, and it's interesting how Wikipedia lays this out, was an alleged, I wonder if they got this article locked, I wouldn't doubt it, was an alleged, my God, give me a break, large-scale program of the United States Central Intelligence Agency that began in the early 1950s and attempted to manipulate news media for propaganda purposes. It funded student and cultural organizations and magazines as front organizations. There we go. People can look into that a little more as they so choose. But just in brief, the Five Eyes.
Well, Five Eyes, I believe what you're referring to is the, this isn't confirmed, of course, but I always have wondered if Five Eyes is basically the child of CASAB. And CASAB was a group that was started in the 60s because Hoover was actually a very negative effect, not only on, you know, some of American history, but he was a negative effect on the intelligence community as well, because Hoover and the CIA had been playing a game of cat and mouse for decades. The CIA actually took away power from Hoover when it was created, which is why he didn't like the CIA and the CIA felt mutually. Because at one point, when just the FBI existed, they controlled not only domestic intelligence, but foreign as well. So there were FBI bases all over the world that got shut down and transferred over to the CIA when it was created and took over foreign intelligence. So CASAB was a group that was created by James Angleton with one of the assistant directors of the FBI and other foreign intelligence groups to share information without telling their leadership, who would often not want them to share that information with other groups so it wouldn't be compromised. I believe CASAB stood for C for Canada, A for America, Z for New Zealand, A for Australia, and B for Britain, yeah, which is what I think Five Eyes
That's
is.
Right. That's what I just pulled that up here, actually, via the DuckDuckGo.
I just don't think they've ever admitted it used to be CASAB, but I think that's where it started, CASAB, back in the 60s.
I wonder where Mossad and the KGB would figure into the picture. I guess it's all done on a kind of probably quid pro quo basis, I'd imagine.
Yeah. You
know? It's like, well, what?
Well, and they've gotten burned, as we know. I mean, if anybody wants to check out the evidence, you can go to the Mary Farrell Foundation or the National Archives online to see that. There's also an interesting film, you know, and I don't usually recommend films because I'm more for the evidence, but there's a film from a John le Carré book called Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. There's a new version, but I prefer the old version with, why can't I think of his name? He played Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Sir Alec Guinness.
Yes, Alec Guinness plays the lead in that, and he does a really great job of a very well-mannered, quiet spy. So it's a pretty good movie, if you get a chance.
Mary Farrell, who was she exactly?
Mary Farrell was one of the original big names in research when the JFK case. She took interest in the JFK, RFK, MLK, and other assassinations. We're so lucky to be around in this time of, you know, digital advancement where we can access a lot of things that would have required a lot more legwork back in the day. And when Mary Farrell was around, she actually built an addition onto her house because she ran out of room to put files. So she basically had her own self-built library, a building built on to where she lived so that she could store all the things she was looking for. And I mean, imagine digging through, you know, just stacks and stacks of folders rather than just being able to click on a file on your computer and there's the file right there for you. So she was one of the original big names in research. And the Mary Farrell Foundation was started by Rex Bradford and others to basically honor her work and continue her work. And they've put up millions of pages. I think the National Archives, I'm sure when you go to the actual archives proper in Washington, you can get some stuff that you can't get online. But as far as online, I would say the Mary Farrell Foundation not only competes with the National Archives, it exceeds them. Because in the National Archives and a lot of official places, I've noticed, much to my chagrin, that they use transcripts. They type out what supposedly is on the paper rather than the actual document so you can see it for yourself untouched and you can see any of the flaws and problems within it. And to me, that's a lot more useful rather than a transcript, because the transcript you have to take someone's word for. If they give you the actual document like the Mary Farrell Foundation is, you have it in your hand, you know exactly what it says.
I'm not sure. Are you talking about the recent Trump dump?
Well, no, with the recent Trump dump, they actually have the documents up.
Not so fast. What they've got, especially, it's quite telling, too, when it comes to Oswald's alleged role or affiliation activities in connection to the CIA, that, who was it? Richard Helms was being questioned, and right at the moment after the question is delivered, the page ends, and that's all you get to see.
Well, one of the things about that, though, is that his actual full testimony was available in the 90s. So that was just stuff that's already been put out before.
What did he say then? What was his response?
I can go to the Mary Farrell Foundation. Hang on. See if I can find the testimony.
Right. While you're doing that, and as we wind things down here, there was, just in closing, is something, because I know where you stand on, basically, I don't think look upon these. It's interesting how down in Dallas, I guess, there's a couple of conferences, and I'm kind of asking myself, why are there two separate conferences? I guess as things turn out, the JFK investigation and research community is somewhat divided.
Yeah. Personally, people are going to vary from person to person what their opinion is of that. And my view of that is that it's basically divided into those who use evidence and those who do not. And I would say that the JFK Lancer Conference, the one that I've presented at and maybe will again in the future, is the one that uses evidence. Unfortunately, there's another conference led by Judith Vary Baker, who your listeners might have heard of before, that relies on a lot of speculation and claims with no proof. And that's the big division. Some people try to say it has to do with other things. To me, that's the big problem. Some people are making progress, some people aren't, and some people are just trying to make a spectacle of what's going on and making grand claims that they can't prove. And over, myself and others, I mean, there's dozens of other people would like to go to my blog. I've written multiple articles and I have citations of evidence that you can see the original evidence for yourself and see the problem with her entire story and that entire conference. That's... Unfortunately, some people value being seen more than they value actually proving what they're claiming. That's what I see as the big difference.
And your blog can be found at www.tpaak, that's TPAAK.com. And that stands, I believe, for two princes and a king. Quite extensive was my impression, quite impressive. And you've done a lot of work. You're certainly committed to the cause. So you deserve a lot of credit.
Thank you.
For that. You know, Rob Clark, we had him on, as you know. I'm not sure. I guess you might consider him something of a friend.
Yep.
We had him on. And in fact, you are welcome to join us this November. We try to every year have, because it's such a fascinating story, the JFK Roundtable. Once again, John Barber was the featured guest this past year. I believe Rob was 2 years ago. So perhaps, you know, it's an open invitation, though, once again.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I'd love to come back.
Now, I'm not sure how things would proceed or unfold with you and Judith Very Baker.
I would love to debate her if she'd ever, you know, agree to have a long conversation with me.
Now, here's the thing why I mentioned Rob Clark. Beverly Babushka Lady Oliver.
Yes.
I just, you know, I've seen pictures of the Babushka Lady up close. I believe there are a few that you can see if you dig around online. Unless my memory is all hazy and mushy, as you earlier had alluded to, with some people not as clearly recollecting as they might think. But she looked kind of old, if you ask me. Like, I was thinking, this lady looks like my grandmother. She does not look like some young, attractive waitress.
I totally agree.
At all.
I totally agree.
So, and what's going on, man?
I totally agree. And you... Oh, I was just going to say, you'll find her at that other conference I was talking about.
Well, why do people do this? What's going on? Is it just a monetary incentive or partially a little unstable? And I'm not really naming any names other than Beverly Oliver here. Judith Very Baker, I will personally leave aside for the moment because I think she has – her story deserves to be – and her voice, you know.
I have no problem with her wanting to tell her story. I have a problem with her proving story. It's like people have tried to say, you know, they've tried to say that I don't like her as a person. I don't know her as a person. And frankly, I don't care about her or anyone else as a person in this. I'm just trying to find answers. And if you can provide me evidence so that you can verify what you're saying, good. If you can't, I'm not interested. And that's the problem I have with her. And largely it applies to Beverly Oliver and a lot of the other people that go to her conference and that they say all these things. Like Beverly Oliver, she says that she, okay, what sort of sense does this make when you really come down and think about it? There's a young, pretty girl. And she's not just going to go dressed as herself. She's going to put on a dark wig. She's going to put on glasses. She's going to hunch over so she looks like a little old lady. And she's going to use, you know, just the holes in her story remind me of Baker's story. Because, you know, for instance, you know, Beverly Oliver, she claimed to have a camera that later on was debunked. It showed that camera didn't exist in the year she was supposed to have had it. It wasn't actually created till later. She claims to have talked to, I believe it was Regis Kennedy in the FBI. Unfortunately, Kennedy was in New Orleans during the time that she claims to have talked to him in Dallas. He didn't come till later. Similarly, when you go to the other side with Judith Very Baker, one of the things I pointed out at Lancer last year was she claims that Dr. Edward Alden Ochsner was the person who was in charge of all the stuff she was supposedly doing for the CIA and the Castro plots. But there's no documentation whatsoever. And why would they have destroyed only the stuff to do with her and not destroyed all the Castro plots documents? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you can't find anything on Oswald Harley either. It's all.
But with Oswald, there still is a substantial amount of information. Another thing is that I actually have a document that shows that Ochsner, yes, he was a CIA contact, but he had nothing to do with the Castro plots. And he ceased personal contact in 1962. So that's before she says all this stuff happened. So the problem, and they have no reason to lie to themselves internally. So there's no reason for them to lie in that document. There's a reason why she doesn't exist in any primary evidence. Like, I would challenge people to show me one piece of primary evidence that can be verified that she's in, that has anything to do.
She was a hotshot cancer researcher, very bright young lady who was recruited and did end up moving to New Orleans for cancer research. Has that not been substantiated?
No, there's no proof of that
there
whatsoever.
There was a
and
news
here's
article
problem.
Of her winning an award, I believe, correct?
Oh, yes. No, she won an award while she was in high school, but here's the problem. It takes roughly 10 years to get all the credentials necessary to become a cancer researcher. She never got them. She never attended college. She never went through the training. She basically is trying to claim that, I suppose, through osmosis, she somehow had this magical knowledge to do all these things that it takes everyone else 10 years to go to school for. That's a problem. She doesn't have any of the scientific credentials. She didn't have the lab necessary. She didn't have the funding necessary. She didn't have the training necessary. She's just claiming things. And unless she can produce these degrees that she somehow got, she started at the age of 12, so that she could do all these things by the time she was 19 that she's claiming to do, it's unbelievable. It's wholly ridiculous, in my opinion.
Joe Pyatt chiming in, asking, how about that monkey? What's up with that? So I believe that would be an allusion to Dr. Mary's monkey.
Yeah, indeed. Well, there are two versions of that book if you look it up. There's a first edition that doesn't have Judith Ferry Baker, and then there's a better-selling second edition that does. So I'd say that's the answer to that.
Who is it that publishes her books? It's, I believe...
Trinday.
And which is run by...
Chris Milligan, the son of a former CIA operative.
It's interesting go ahead.
People have tried to say that she had some connection with the CIA. If Judith Baker has a connection with the CIA, in my opinion, the only one that would verifiably be reasonable based on all the stuff she said that can't be proven is a disinformation agent. That's the only use I could see her having for the agency, because she doesn't have any of the skills necessary to have all these other things happen that she claimed. I mean, it's a great story. It really lures people in. It's got all the emotional, tantalizing things people want. It's got some romance. It's got spycraft here and there. But when you look at the substance of it, it falls apart. I've read her books. Like, that's another thing they always say is, well, have you read her books? Yes, I have. And color me unimpressed. Because when you go through them and check the sources, there's no verification that can happen.
You know, it's interesting talking about Chris Milligan. We had invited him to be a part of our show on two separate occasions. And after the second time that he did not bother to appear, the captain actually ordered he be keel-hauled. He's the only guest that we've had to treat in that rough-shod, kind of heavy-handed manner. But, I mean, hey, two separate occasions he was formally booked, and I guess the captain decided he could let the first time go, give him a bit of a pass, and it happened again. And then we never heard back from the guy. We totally got ghosted, if that makes any sense. So, anyways, let's just leave things at that for now. I know it's getting late out there in the East Coast. The Michigan.
You got me on a subject I could talk forever about.
Well, if you got a little more gas, if you have a little more gas in the tank, what we typically do here every week is put together a post-show feature content conversation that runs for about an hour. So that's where we try to kind of draw the line. We'll take a bit of a break here for a couple minutes, and if you join us, that's great. Otherwise, I end up just kind of hanging around waiting for people to drop in. All kinds of magic and surprises can and do happen here via the show, Pirate Radio Podcast. It's been a great time. I've really enjoyed your conversation and what you've had to bring to the table here, Carmine. Just any last closing thoughts or comments?
Well, I just want to thank everybody for listening. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk. And, as I said, and myself included, I appreciate those who enjoyed what I had to say, but feel free to verify it and do that with everybody. Don't just take people at their word. Ironically, it reminds me of a thing that the CIA says, trust but verify. So that is something we should always do, especially when dealing with the CIA. I wouldn't trust in the first place, but verify. Always verify what people are saying to be accurate, because you'd be surprised, all manner of people, the tales they could tell, no matter how believable they might sound.
I believe another motto from the CIA, something that they have that you can find as you enter into their, I guess it's Langley headquarters, is, how does it read now? The truth shall set you free. So, on that note, once again, thank you very much. We've got, of course, your blog mostly is what you've shared with us here as far as contact information. You are the author, of course, of Two Princes and a King, a concise review of three political assassinations. How can people get a hold or a copy of your book? Via Amazon?
Yeah, you can find it on Amazon, CreateSpace, and most major stores. It can be ordered through if they don't carry copies. I know Walmart and NetBorders, I can't remember. As you know, I'm sure the bookstores have closed down a lot around the U.S.
Amazon is actually said to be...
Amazon's probably the best place to... Yeah, we've lost a lot of local bookstores, but it is at a few major stores, and you can get it on Amazon and CreateSpace.
TPAC.com, that's the website people will want to check out, TPAAK. So thank you once again, Carmine. It's been a blast. Just stick around, and we will talk to you in just a moment or two. as we queue up the outro. But on that note, until we meet again, on behalf of Captain Long John Sinclair and all the rest of the crew of the Robin Hood, that's a wrap for episode 94 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder.
I know. There we be. Having carefully looked over each of our navigation panel instruments, checking every level, switch, dial, cable, knob and pulley, by all accounts and indications, we indeed see it's time once again to drop anchor inside Mystic Bay and draw an end to another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. Remember, if you're looking for a little more lively online action, keep in mind we've likely got yet another great free-flowing Rogues Gallery After Show coming up for the next hour in either Skype, Google Hangouts, or Peer.in. Also, if you've in any way enjoyed or found yourself benefiting from the shows we've tirelessly produced over the past 2 years, you might want to drop by our Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. Half of all network donations go directly to charity. Help to keep those numbers growing over on Patreon, and we'll be able to extend even more of a generous pirate hand. Looking forward now to the balance of 2018, we're still not quite yet booked. So if you yourself have a new, novel, intriguing, or otherwise underreported idea, unique individual, or pressing item in mind, be sure to either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or fire us a quick email via PirateOneRadio@gmail.com. We're always open to exploring fresh creative suggestions, intriguing guest ideas, cutting-edge discussion topics, and captivating themes. You can further embark on your own personal pirate journey by either liking, commenting on, subscribing to, or just following us via virtually any mainstream social media platform, including Twitter, Facebook, Google+, or Minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tally-ho.